Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Divin, your host, and this is a special monthly broadcast that we're going to be bringing your way at the end of every month for the next 12 in 2014. This is Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And with me on the program today as my co-host for these broadcasts throughout 2014 is Will Lynn. And Will, I've had on the program before. We talked about the mythology surrounding Prometheus and how if I were to have a god to represent this program, that would be the appropriate god to have because he is the god of new paradigms.
Absolutely.
And if I'm remembering correctly, he first brought to us the first paradigm shift had to do with fire. And there's a new one that's sort of in transition. We're sort of in the middle of it in our modern day and time. And that has to do with what?
Well, from the following the Prometheus story, after he steals fire, he gets chained to a stone for a long, long time until finally the savior and hero of humanity, Heracles, sets him free from the stone. And so in the last program, I was talking about how the second paradigm shift that he represents is the liberation from stone, which I'd like to interpret as a liberation from materialism.
Okay, and that's what a lot of people are going through. But in these 12 programs that we're doing for Tell Me Your Story, we're going to be focusing on, as I've alluded to, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And that there is a great deal that we can derive from mythology. You are in the process, as we begin these series, of working on your dissertation, correct?
I am.
And your dissertation focal point is?
Well, the topic area are origin stories of knowledge and myth. So particularly in the West for me, so I can focus down a little bit, but particularly Adam and Eve, Prometheus and Pandora, and then the story we always tell of the origin of knowledge with philosophy in Greece.
And I know that from your perspective, all of this is extremely important.
Yeah.
And we're going to dive into that as we continue forward. But give us a little bit of an idea of where you and your guests are going to be taking us on this journey over the next 12 months.
Well, I've had the opportunity to invite a number of guests, and so far what it looks like is we'll be able to talk to some people that can well, today we'll talk especially about epic, and then another time we'll be able to talk especially about myth, and another time particularly about folklore, about the news, about literature, and all these different corners of the study of story. And so by looking at story and psychology too, because one of the main focuses that I'd like to hopefully keep going is to make sure we're not looking at ancient myths without looking at moving forward in story. So for example, today with Dennis, he'll be talking, I expect, a little bit about memory. And one of his main focuses is on how myths, especially epics, can help connect the memory of the past into the forward steps of the future.
When you talk about epics, what do you mean?
Well, some of these here, I've got Gilgamesh, and I've got the Divine Comedy, and the Odyssey, the Iliad. These are the standard examples, but Dennis also teaches, and Dennis Slattery, by the way, Dennis teaches Toni Morrison's Beloved and Moby Dick, and these are more modern, what some people may decide to call epics. And I suspect we'll get to talk about that a little more later when we have Dennis on. But the main difference of an epic may be that an epic takes already existing myths, already existing memory, already existing culture, and synergizes it into not just into a story, but into a story on which a culture can found itself and through which a culture can identify. So when Virgil created the Aeneid, he was making an epic that all the Romans could identify through. And so I think that's one of the primary functions of an epic, is to establish cultural cohesion.
Well, let me ask you, in terms of the various civilizations down through history, have most of them, if not all of them, used some form of mythology as a foundation for their society?
Yeah, I mean, I think the separating out of mythology and culture is only something that can happen after you sever the relationship between mythology and culture, because for example, up until the Scientific Revolution, the separation of religion and culture was vague at best, you know, and the same would have been true with all kinds of ancient cultures where their myths, their stories, their symbols, their magic mm-hmm. was a living part of their daily life as much as science is for us.
This is fascinating to me, and I've shared this with you before, and I want you to sort of expound on this in terms of our modern day mythology. Had a wonderful conversation with a good friend of mine years ago. We're both Trekkies and loved especially the Next Generation series. Mm-hmm. And he told me his perspective on that particular series. He says, that's our modern day mythology. And if you agree with that, why?
Well, I'd say two layers of an answer to that. The first is simple popularity of a story will indicate how much it's being received by a culture. But second, the particular genre that Star Trek represents, the sci-fi genre, Joseph Campbell and others have commented that it is the genre of our current mythic imagination. So where Star Trek may be a specific modern myth or modern epic, and I would definitely agree that it is, its genre also represents a new genre in the mythic imagination, and that being science fiction, science fantasy. And I think there's a lot of strong arguments for the belief that science is our living mythology now.
It is said that there is always some element of truth in mythology, mm-hmm. in these stories. And so when we – because some people will even look at the Bible mm-hmm. at a certain level mm-hmm. as mythological. Mm-hmm. However, there are those who have taken those stories and said, yes, they are mythological. However, we're going to take a look at whatever evidence we can find to support these stories in as much as why would they have written about, for example, these – beings coming out of the sky, mm-hmm. and then of course you start getting into those who believe in
aliens.
Exactly. Right. So, is that a fair statement to make about mythology across the board, whether you're talking about Greek or Roman mm-hmm. or whatever civilization, that somehow they've changed the stories mm-hmm. To hide those kinds of truths?
Well, I definitely think there's no way around the fact that a lot of the myths, I can speak most specifically about Greek myths that we have, are consciously changed and coded. Because, for example, the myth of Persephone and Demeter is talking about a ritual that likely preceded the myth. And the ritual at Eleusis is a secret, absolutely secret. In fact, Alcibiades was kicked out of Athens for, among other things, being too open about the secrets. And so myths, when they're stories that have come from rituals and have come from secrets, you can count on them being a little bit encoded and a little bit mysterious. Now, the question of whether or not what they're encoding are aliens, the origin of the Holy Grail, all these wonderful imaginal things, I don't know. I think that it's hard to be sure what they're actually trying to communicate, and that's part of the fun. I've certainly spent my time deep in the imagination and wanting to believe various things that they might be talking about. And I have my secular moments and my deep believer moments. And that's part of the play of myth, is you can never be sure. You can never necessarily know what the transcendent truth that they're pointing to is. But I've heard good arguments for aliens, and I've heard good arguments for historical experiences.
For example, the Holy Grail. Some people will say that was Mary Magdalene mm-hmm. in particular. Mm-hmm. Some people say it's a literal physical chalice or goblet. Mm-hmm. Other people might even say that was the Holy Grail might have been actually the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, sure.
And so on and so on. And so everybody, all of these stories get started, mm-hmm. and which one is true and which one is fiction, if you will, to fiction or nonfiction. I guess is sort of each individual has to make up their own mind because there is no one right answer.
You know what I really like is J.R.R. Tolkien, who is an incredible scholar but also obviously an incredible myth maker. Mm-hmm. And he wrote one essay on the study of myth and in his case, fairy stories. And in it, he talks about how the artist who writes a story, they have every story that they've ever heard in their imagination. Mm-hmm. So when they go to move forward to write something, it's likely that it will be inspired by many things. And in fact, Say there's a story where the Holy Grail is Mary Magdalene. Say there's a story where the Holy Grail is the cup that Joseph of Arimathea carried. And say there's another story that it's actually a Celtic vessel that Bran had in Wales. Well, those are just three of many, many things that the Grail could be based on. I particularly like the idea that the storytellers that created these stories were inspired by the similarities of the stories. And when they find the similarities, they allow for the congealing and the increasing richness of imagination. And while this is – it's risky to say that about religion, stories in religion, I think for stories like Grail myths or Tolkien's epics, I think that's likely how it went. And that concentration on the lack of linearity, lack of singularity, and appreciation of richness and confluence, that's part of what really gets me going about myth.
Well, these 12 programs are very interesting from my perspective because I'm going to be in studio with you, who is the student.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say expert because you're bringing in the experts.
Definitely student.
And myself, the novice, who has not read the great classical mythological stories. I'm aware of some of the characters. I'm aware of some of the Greek gods, Zeus and Plato and on and on and on. I don't know that Plato was, but it's going to be a very interesting series of 12 programs. Tell us in today's program with Dennis Slattery, tell us a little bit about him. Give our folks, our listeners, an introduction to Dennis Slattery, as well as where we're going today.
Well, I promise that just before Dennis comes on, I'll do a full official introduction. But to introduce you basically about Dennis on a more personal level, you know, I know the man. Dennis was a part of a really important movement and community that participated in the study of story. Dennis lives in Texas now, and there was a major movement in Dallas within the humanities. There's a man named James Hillman who used to hold a key position at the C.G. Jung Institute, and he moved to Dallas. And around him and a number of other figures like Louise Cowan, a number of humanities scholars and students started to gather. And Dennis wasn't only one of those students. He became, you know, one of the real leaders of this community in Dallas. And then eventually this community, some of this community, started to branch out into Santa Barbara, where some other groups had been starting to make some things happen. And so Dennis really represents a bridge between this group in Dallas and this group in Santa Barbara. And he's more than a bridge. He's the pillar on both sides.
Mm.
You know, he's taught me personally more about myth than I think most people get to learn in a lifetime. And I'm really looking forward to getting a chance to talk with him about some of his specialties and main focuses, mainly memory, mimesis, and embodiment. And I'm really looking forward to talking about mimesis because mimesis plays a huge role in myth, as does memory. And I dare not risk words that'll be improved upon by Dennis.
Define for me the word mimesis.
Mimesis is basically another word for congruence. And basically what it is if one pattern in one situation is just like another pattern in another situation, they are miming each other. So here's an example. When Heracles dies, he marries the cupbearer of the gods, drinks the elixir, and then he becomes immortal. When somebody finds the Holy Grail, they drink the elixir, and then they also become immortal. These are mimetic stories. And then you might also say, when I met my girlfriend, she transformed me and opened up my heart in the way that the Holy Grail does, or in the way that the cup that Heracles drank from, the effect that it has. That would also be mimetic. And so mimetic is a sort of congruity or parallel pattern. And this is what makes these stories so powerful, is that the patterns in the story are mimetic with our own lives. They're mimetic with the stories of our culture. And it's through this mimesis and this sensitivity to the common patterns that these stories seem to come alive into our own realities.
Well, this is going to be fascinating, just this one program alone. And we have so many different directions that we're going to be going, but they're all going to be tied into this whole subject of mythosophia. if that's correctly pronounced and accented?
Well, actually, I'd like to take the opportunity to say we're going to go with Mythosophia, but originally I'd been interested in saying Mythosophia, like Philosophia.
Mythosophia.
But I it's going to be too complicated to pronounce and to expect people
then.
To spell it. Mythosophia.
Entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom, which I think is fantastic because there is great wisdom to be derived from these stories. I think of Aesop's Fables mm-hmm. as one, and I watched cartoons, you know, on mm-hmm. On Saturday mornings where they would run these, and the moral was still there in addition to the humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great deal that we can learn from these, and they can guide us along. And I thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this kind of information to our listeners.
Well, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this stuff and to invite these people to come talk with us.
We're going to come back and we're going to have Dennis Slattery with us. He is going to be sharing with us his perspectives, if you will, on Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And you can also go to facebook.com/Mythosophia, MYTHOSOPHIA, and get more information. And these radio programs are being recorded. The video is going to be available for you to watch, be able to see us if you choose to do so. And you can start at facebook.com/Mythosophia. And Will Lynn and I will be back. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, subtitling Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And we will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I have a co-host today on the program, and I will for the next... the next 12 Saturdays at the end of each month, and his name is Will Lynn, and I want to welcome you back to our program. We're talking about Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. And just to let our listeners know, there's a Facebook page, and it is facebook.com/Mythosophia. That's MYTHOSOPHIA. And it's really nice to continue our discussion here about mythology, which dives into so many other areas. But today's focus is going to be on our guest who is in studio with us, Dennis Slattery. And I'm going to have you, Will, introduce Dennis, give our listeners a little bit of a background, and then we're going to jump right into our topic.
Well, in the earlier segment, I mentioned just a little bit about Dennis on a personal level, but to give a real official introduction, Dennis Patrick Slattery is currently a core faculty member in the Mythological Studies program at the Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, California. He's taught for 43 years at the elementary, secondary, undergraduate, and graduate levels. From 1984 to 1987, he taught teachers the classics of literature at the Dallas Institute of the Humanities and Culture Summer Program for Teachers, directed by Louise Cowan. He also taught for 6 years at the Fairhope Institute of Humanities and Culture Summer Program for High School Teachers under the direction of Dr. Larry Alums, who is the current director of the Dallas Institute. So welcome, Dennis.
Welcome. Thank you, Will. And Richard?
Pleasure to have you with us.
This is a treat.
Jump into this. This is the first program of 12. As
beautiful.
I've mentioned a number of occasions, we've slotted the last Saturday of each month to talk about mythology, and in this case, the subtitle Mythosophia. So, Dan, Will, let's have you start us off as far as where are we going with Dennis on this journey today?
Well, as I just read, Dennis has been teaching at every level, so I thought that would be a great opportunity for us to start at the very beginning. Dennis, what is myth?
What is myth?
What is myth?
Yeah. I wrote myself, I continually write definitions of what myth is mm-hmm. to myself in my journal. And the other day I wrote that myth is what allows us to stand up in a strong wind. In other words, it gives us, myths give us support. They allow us to have a flexibility rather than a fixation. Myths also, and here I'm going to steal from Rollo May in his wonderful book, The Cry for Myth. He says that a person without a myth is a person without a home. When we live a mythless life, We live an orphaned life. So there's a part of what myth is that grounds us in place. 7 or 8 years ago, I became more and more dissatisfied with the idea that myth is story. Mm-hmm. Now, in the original Greek, I've seen two translations. Myth is story. Also, myth is word. Hmm. But what began to intrigue me, Will, is what is it behind the story that helps to give it some shape and form? Mm-hmm. And is there something even behind that? So where I find the juice for me, taking nothing away from Narcissus and Echo and from Achilles and from all of the wonderful figures in myth, is what kind of energy fields rest behind these delicious mythical stories that find their way into film and into advertisement, into short stories, contemporary short stories, today. Mm-hmm. And here's where I am. There's the story. Behind the story is an archetypal reservoir that the story is pulling from. Mm-hmm. Behind that is an archetypal energy field that coagulates into this into forms of this archetypal reservoir, and out of that we get narrative. So it's a regress. Now, is this accurate? I've stopped worrying about being right or wrong. Is this right on the beam? Is this inaccurate? But rather to play with the idea of what myth has been, but also what myth could be.
Well, it's somewhat obvious when you're talking about this reservoir in these fields. You're not just letting it pour out of your brain. It looks like you're almost there, and when you're talking about it. And so, if there's anything that speaks to its reality, it's the fact that it does seem to be a place that sometimes you can enter in. It's more than a thought, it's a feeling. When you feel this symbol, like this symbol, there's a feeling in their deeper congruity and in deeper relationship. And that's part of why I asked you on, is because nobody seems to live in that reality like you do, Dennis.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, and please, if you have comments or questions, because I can push this just a little bit further.
Yeah, please do.
So story is shaped. One of the many things that the Greeks discovered that I find very exciting is the idea of poesis. And that is a making or a shaping something to give it a coherent form. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think classics in literature, not just in the West, but worldwide, and also sculpture and painting. But the area that I feel like I've got a couple of things to say about is literature, poetry, and writing. So poems are one form of poesis. Short stories, another form. Epic is another. All forms of poetry, lyric poetry, are all manifestations of this fundamental ground of creative impulses that I think every human being has. Some go ahead and work towards expressing it. Others don't. They mm-hmm. fold in on it. So this notion of poesis as a making is something that has intrigued me since I studied with Louise Cowan at the University of Dallas in the early 70s.
So I got to take a class with you. I think it was the epic class.
It was epic.
And it was during the time I was taking an alchemy class. And I felt like the way that you talked about poesis and the way that Lance Smith was talking about alchemy, they really congealed for me, and as a way to look at a process of creation. And for a young man, that's kind of hard, because we like to think that it's an off-on, or it's take the next step and you're there the next step, as opposed to every step is characteristically different.
Yes.
And that's hard. That's not how it is for, you know, simple mechanics. That's how it is for baking, for alchemizing, for growing food and these kinds of things. And so there are a lot of poetic ways to describe poesis.
Yes.
And that is, I think, a act of poiesis itself.
It is. My wife is an avid cross-stitcher. She has been for 45 years. She'll sit in front of the TV in the evening with me, and she is in that cross-stitch world, and she might as well be on a bus 1,000 miles from our house. She's in that poetic field because she's in the process of giving something a shape that otherwise would remain a pile of different colored threads on the table. So I couldn't agree more that poesis is that creative act. And if it's rebuilding a 57 Chevy six-cylinder engine, that's a poetic move. It can be.
Yeah.
It can be.
Well, it certainly is an exciting life when you let it be.
When you let it be, yes.
And I think that's part of the impulse of this program is to continue to push mythology into the field of everyday life and to allow everyday life to become increasingly mythic. When I was 17, I went through a little existential phase of thinking, well, what is the purpose? Where is meaning? And I could find, I didn't know where to even look for meaning. What is meaning? How, where is the ground? Where is the foundation? But now through the study of mythology and philosophy too, but especially mythology, everything seems grounded in meaning. Everything is grounded in context. And that's one thing that, that you talk about with epics and myth as founding stories, as maybe you could say a little bit about that, about how an epic may serve the function of founding.
Yes. No, that's a good one. Founding, and we could even say refounding. You know, I'm thinking of Aeneas when he takes his father and his son from the burning walls of Troy, and then he gathers the Lares, the household gods, with him. And they leave, and his wife Creusa keeps the Greeks deflected until they can make their escape because they're on their way to refound a city. And it'll, of course, it'll be Rome. So there's a movement in which something can be founded, a movement in which something can be refounded, as Odysseus, in essence, refounds Ithaca, pulling it away from the suitors who are going to level it. And that speaks to, I think, one of the deepest archetypal patterns that's in us as human beings. We want to leave a trace in the world. Some do it through terrible acts of violence. Others do it by leaving a marble pietà for the world to enjoy. But I think there is an epic impulse in all of us to mark the world as it's continually marking and scarring us. We can't escape that, nor I don't think we even should. But we really want to found, I think we want to find something, and I think we want to found something. And those are often in that order. So these literary genres, and I'm just going to touch base with Louise Cowan's four genre structures that you know about, lyric, tragedy, comedy, and epic, which she developed and taught for 65 years. Each of those are movements of the soul towards a particular itinerary in life. But at the base of them, and the one that contains all of them, is epic. Because I think it's that founding principle that is implicated in all four.
You said that I think it was Rollo May you referenced, a person without a myth is a person without a home. And so it seems like, in many ways, these founding stories are giving a home for people to exist. And it reminds me of a line from Socrates, courage is primarily of the philosophical disposition. Because if you don't have something you believe in, you don't have anything to be courageous about. Courage is just blind young man's willingness to risk his life.
Yes.
You know, so so I think you might say the same thing with myth. Myth is the source of true courage. It just as philosophy is. It's that pattern which you believe in deep down on a personal level.
Yes. You know, I think Campbell really got it right in Hero with a Thousand Faces when he laid out that structure for the heroic. First, you have to hear a call. And there are people who remain deaf to being called to anything and live a whole life and die, not uncalled, but unable to hear it. The next phase is to heed the call. But because we have free will, we can refuse the call as well. But I love the third part. If one hears a calling and heeds the calling, the third movement is you must give yourself over to something greater than you are. That, for me, is where courage really gathers, coagulates, because to give oneself up and to allow the ego to kind of dissolve in the face of something bigger is epically courageous.
That's very interesting. It's something that Will and I had talked about not only on our previous program, but in conversations since. And as Will and I have chatted, and this is the first time you've probably heard this, maybe not, the modern day Star Trek Next Generation was dubbed by a very good friend of mine back in Phoenix as we would chat about this, both of us big Trekkie fans. The Next Generation series specifically was, as he put it, our modern day mythology. Oh. But as you have spoken about this aspect of hearing the call, heeding the call, and then giving yourself up to a higher power. Now, then this is sort of the first time I've actually put it in this context on the radio broadcast. And so I want people to understand that I'm not advocating anything. I am just putting forth an idea.
Good.
You're familiar with the series.
I am, but not
– I won't go
I
into detail.
I'm not going to be
no,
quizzed.
No, no, you're not going to be quizzed. No. Okay. You're familiar with one of the characters that was brought in called the Borg.
The Borg.
Yes.
The collective.
Yes.
And setting aside the destructive habits of the Borg to assimilate other civilizations against their will, there is no one singular mind that is in control. It is the collective. Yet, and they function quite well. They get the job done, whatever it might be. When we talk about, and Will and I talked about this just recently, the intuition.
Yeah.
And let's use that as the context for hearing the call. I instruct people that they should listen to their intuition, that it will never, ever, 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 ever lead you astray, that it will never put you in harm's way. It will challenge you, but it will never put you in harm's way. Then the next step is, and I went through a personal growth program of an intensive, a five-day intensive, where I wrote down on a piece of big old piece of paper that I was not just going to listen to the still small voice, but I was going to follow through. I was going to do what it asked me to do. What's the point of listening if you're not going to follow it? You know, if you're not going to follow it, then don't listen.
Oh my gosh, you're like the paradox. The beauty in the paradox you're describing is awesome. You're saying you have to submit your own self to listen to yourself. Submit your own self and dissolve your own self in order to listen to yourself.
In a manner, exactly. But then there comes the other element that you and I talked about just a few days ago. And that has to do with this whole business of free will and, yes, the ego, but also, and I'm going to tie in the Borg into this. When you choose to do the first two steps, you are basically acknowledging that you are now, in a manner of speaking, giving up your will for the collective, for the good of all. And for example, there are three of us in the room. Each one of us can listen to our individual intuition. And each one of us will be given different directives. However, all three directives are congruent with the big picture, with the collective. So there is so it's almost as if, and you talked, you and I talked about this, Will, in terms of where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. Where we've been, the one. Where we are, duality, Maya, the illusion. Where we're going, the one. And in order to get back to the one, we have to go through this individualistic mentality, mindset, in order to make the next step that I've just described of saying, how willing are you to bring about a better life for all? Yeah. Are you willing to let go of the self?
Yeah.
So are there so is this at this level, is this the importance of mythology in our lifetime today? To teach us that, to show us that?
Yeah, and it's the basis of Buddhism as well as mm-hmm. as I understand it. That
I'm sorry, Buddhism?
Buddhism.
Oh, Buddhism. I beg your pardon. Okay.
And I read Buddhist thought as I teach the Divine Comedy, and it's astonishing how they are in such great correspondence. Self-absorption is hell itself in the Buddhist thought, most specifically in Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, written in the 8th century. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what's taking place in the three canticas of Dante's Divine Comedy. All of the souls in Inferno suffer alone. All of the souls in Purgatory suffer in community. Now they're suffering, but they're on a different qualitative level, and they're also suffering in hope. It's different to suffer hopelessly, and it's to suffer hopefully. And those two realms constitute 70% of the entire journey. Now, what has happened to the souls in Inferno? They made themselves their own deity. And they were then caught in a myth that calcified and fixated. And that's their condition for eternity as Dante travels through it.
Imprison themselves in themselves.
They're imprisoned in themselves. And, I mean, I forget the Shakespeare play, might be Hamlet. We make a heaven of hell or hell of heaven. We do that to ourselves, mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. Othello, one of the tragedies. But in the purgatorial realm, one suffers in community and gets out of oneself in actually helping others make it up Mount Purgatory. And then in the last realm, they are already in that state of a kind of mystical bliss, a very tough part of the poem, to grasp, in part because it moves towards abstraction. But the other two worlds are very fleshy, very meaty. The ones in Purgatorio are, I think, are the ones who are still living in a viable, organic myth. In Inferno, they have frozen. And then we get the figure of Satan himself, deep in the bowels of that cone, and he's frozen in ice. So hell, on one level, isn't about fire. It's about frozenness in ice.
Mm-hmm.
So,
stuck, basically.
Richard, I hope that at least touched on when a myth dehydrates, becomes anemic, mm-hmm. it moves towards fundamentalism mm-hmm. in all of its forms. Mm-hmm. So if we look around the world today at the forms of fundamentalism, which can be about a religious fundamentalism, but maybe about fundamentalism on what you're eating.
Even science.
And yeah. science.
Politics, science.
Politics. It's, yeah. it's an attitude, mm-hmm. and it's a rigid paralysis. So I don't think there's any more practical discipline to study today than mythology. I think if taken seriously, it would make countries question, do we understand this adversary's myth? And given our understanding of it, is invading this country really in our best interest? In other words, my fantasy has been for years that the president ought to have a mythologist on his board of advisors, his or her.
We
I'm going to stay the
one.
Open up. because the perspective that myth gives gets outside of policy,
mm-hmm.
which itself yeah. is a policy making is a mythic structure, but it is not conscious of itself in ways that I think it could be if mythically inflected.
I know that a lot of people are listening including myself, who haven't read the classic myths. Mm. I mean, Will has a pile of books over here to my left that I've never seen before in my life, let alone read. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of the Greek gods, for example. Yeah. I've heard some of them, and we talked about Aesop's fables. Those are mythical stories with a moral to them, and so forth. And so when the two of you are dialoguing, I must extrapolate as much as I can from the words I do understand.
Sure.
And it's almost as though we sort of need a dictionary or something of this nature. So let me ask you, I know what my metaphysical primer is.
Yes.
What would be a good mythological primer for the beginner who is intrigued by everything that's being spoken about here? Such as myself, but doesn't really have the time or the inclination to read some of these massive volumes as much as we'd like to. And that's where I feel our educational system has really dropped the ball, because I think that so much time is wasted on things that have no relevance.
No, that's right.
So tell me, what would be a good primer?
Well, he's just opened the so beautifully.
Have I opened Pandora's box?
No, you've opened a segue. The fundamental intention in writing this book was to be a primer for people who want. Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Okay. Who
and tell us the book's title for the radio listener.
Yes, it's entitled "Writing Myth, Mythic Writing," but you can't see the spelling. The first writing is R-I-T-I-N-G.
Okay.
The second writing adds a W, because writing is, I believe, a ritual way to get at knowing something that one has maybe half formed.
Mm-hmm.
The intention of the book is to engage the reader's myth. Let me just name a couple of chapters. Engaging the myth that writes you, with an R, not W. Writing the aesthetic self, mythopoiesis. Writing through the embodied self. Writing the wounded self. So the intention of the book is to offer a modest amount of information on myth and inflect it to personal myth, and then invite the reader into their own narrative identity along a particular corridor through a series of questions, because it's my belief that writing opens those parts of us up that even in speaking can still remain concealed.
So you're talking more than just journaling here. Each one of us can actually create our own mythology.
Yes.
Based upon our lives.
Or you might even say we already do have somewhat of a mythology and we don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how many apples are in our movies? How many apples are on teachers' desks? And we don't even think twice when we see that apple that this apple has deep, deep, deep meaning. And we know for a fact Steve Jobs had this particular apple, and even more specifically, Newton's apple in mind when he designed the Apple logo. So I would argue that Pandora, you mentioned Pandora's box. How many diamond advertisements do you see that say Pandora on them? We're inundated by myth, whether we know it or not. I was recently lucky enough to be in Budapest, and I asked my tour guide, I said, do you guys in your classrooms, do you study mythology, classics, etc.? He said, well, if we didn't study the classics, how would we know what's going on in the art in our museums? And I said, you know, I'm not sure that that most of us in the United States could answer that way, you know, because I think a lot of us don't know the art in museums and the apple in the middle of a Disney movie. And I think what you're describing about this book is an opportunity to work into your own personal myth, into the myths of the world, and to find that relationship that is both there and can be developed with myth.
Yes.
Now, there's also an element, too, of symbolism. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're using the symbol of the apple. And the unspoken understanding of the apple can only be derived from having some level of experience with an apple, having some level of experience having heard stories about the apple, mm-hmm. whether it be mm-hmm. from a biblical perspective mm-hmm. or Shakespeare mm-hmm. or the Greek tragedies, et cetera, on infinitum. And, you know, I've often thought about this whole aspect of symbology or mm-hmm. symbolism, in that if I was to take a book and just take, say, the first sentence, every single word evokes an image in mm-hmm. one's mind. Mm-hmm. And then you start putting those words together, and that sentence now starts to evoke a particular image in one's mind, those yeah. symbols, and on and on and on.
And whether you take the time to actually think about those symbols or not, your brain does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now we're starting to get into an area when we start talking about mythology, at least from my understanding, mm-hmm. we're now starting to talk about, if you will, almost subliminal messaging, not just in our modern day marketing and advertising departments, but in terms of authors, movie makers, playwrights, or mm-hmm. just people who are wanting to share their ideas, mm-hmm. such as what we're doing here. The words that we're using are evoking certain images, but the images are not the same from one person to the next. So in a manner of speaking, Dennis, isn't it difficult to get across these ideas to the masses, shall we say, whether it be 100 or 100 million, mm-hmm. because everybody has their own image of those symbols and that symbology.
Yeah.
How do you get that idea out there that you had that people can understand? It's almost like there are three visions of what we want to accomplish in our lives in this room. And mm-hmm. Steve Jobs had a vision. Mm-hmm. And when he died, I said, Apple will never be the same because no one in that company has the vision he had.
Mm-hmm.
How do we?
Well, you give a real good foundation for the listeners, the viewers, to grasp the difference between an archetype, and that's the apple, and the specific archetypal apple that Will had for lunch. That's history. So, or let's go to your word vision. Each of us has a vision because visions are archetypal, but each of us has a specific vision that's biography and history. So, Richard, just that concept, if grasped, would help anyone entering this, it can be very obscure, very murky world of myth. But if people hang on to the idea that myths are patterned ways each of us uses to take in and comprehend the formlessness of events that bombard us during the day, and then the dream images that bombard us at night, because the psyche is always poetically in motion.
Yeah.
That would take people a huge quantum leap into grasping not only myth, but myths. When I teach Joseph Campbell, I like to use the image that myths, if I took my shirt off right now, no, I don't even have to take my shirt off. I can do this as a visual. For me, this is myth.
Mm-hmm.
This is history. I understand myth as the inner sleeve of history. It's helping give this sleeve shape, but it's invisible unless I turn it over.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can see the pattern. Maybe it's reversed or mm-hmm. maybe it's a different pattern. So one's mm-hmm. personal biography, and that which is mythically inflected, dovetails with the larger social myth that each of us is in, both in Santa Barbara, West Coast, United States, and then it just it it goes out. And then finally, for Campbell, and it's even truer today, it's the new myth is the planet. I mean, its survival, her survival, is absolutely contingent on every one of us. In the past, the vision wasn't that great.
Right.
But something happened with that photograph of the sun, of the Earth
jewel,
rising.
They call it, the blue jewel.
The blue
something.
Jewel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that changed consciousness in an instant. And changed a kind of mythic perspective as well.
The planet has been, and this is only a word I've just started to utilize, try not to use it too much, but the Earth has basically been anthropomorphized. Uh-huh. Is that a fair statement?
It had been for a long time, especially. I think that actually may be one of the core qualities of a lot of myths, where, for example, Jeb in the Egyptian tradition, he is the Earth. Mm-hmm. And the Fisher King in the Holy Grail legend, some might say, is healing him is to heal the land, and so with the Blue Jewel, I think myths, one of the demands on myths has always been to establish cohesion where there is not yet cohesion, to establish a bigger frame where a bigger frame is needed. Right now, we need to think holistically about the world as a whole, and so. Right now, that's one of the demands on myth, is to establish that as a frame that people like to see through. And I think in better ways and in worse, it's active doing that.
It is said that you can certainly kill the idea maker, but you can never kill the idea. Mm-hmm. Would the same thing be true of myth, and that if you started a myth— Okay, in the context in which we're speaking here, and not just some story about some celebrity who did something, but they didn't really. I mean, that would be under a different category. And what would it have to contain to endure time?
Mm-hmm. For me, it would have to carry sufficient archetypal energy that gave it a universal heft, so that it would have duration. Without that, there's a good chance it will simply be another passing fad with a lifespan of maybe 18 months. I use this line. I cited this line in Writing Myth, Mythic Writing, because it really helped me understand myth. And I'm forgetting the might be Stanley Krippner, his book on myth. Anyhow, I forget. But the line is, a myth can make a cow sacred in one culture and a hamburger patty in another.
Hmm.
Same animal, two differently inflected, one towards consumption, one's towards worship. Same animal. That brilliant sentence helped me, and so I begin one of the chapters with that as the byline, because you see, Will's term is accurate. Myths are frames; they're also verbs. So we kind of myth along every day of our lives as a kind of a gerund. Maybe
a little more than just embellishing.
Yeah,
it's more than embellishing. Yeah. But embellishing is another really rich word, because I think we are constantly embellishing our history with myth. So we're fabrications, not we're fictions. We're not lies, but the there's a German philosopher, Hans Vaihinger, wrote a book in 1922 called The Philosophy of As If. And the subtitle, which I've never accurately memorized, goes something like this, and I'm gonna embellish. The historical, religious, economic, and social fictions of mankind. And in that book, heavily influenced by Immanuel Kant, is probably 150 as-if fictions that we have the capacity to live by. Well, the more I read him, the more I want to say that myths are as if propositions that we create to help us get through the day, mm-hmm. if not a lifetime, or especially over a crisis, the loss mm-hmm. of a family member, a divorce, something where we really take a traumatic hit. Do we splinter and fall apart, or does the myth that we believe in help us at least stay coherent enough to heal and maybe be reassembled mm-hmm. In the healing?
So the myth that the person is in a better place.
Or that's an example. Or say you have your own personal story, and the death of this person, while it's completely about their life, impacts you in such a way that it impacts your personal story.
Yeah.
So I'm active in weaving that experience into my story. And so emotions mm-hmm. are very frequently emotions are encased within a narrative. You know, emotions only come because of a narrative. In mm-hmm. fact, if I'm happy or angry with somebody, it's probably because I'm telling myself a narrative that makes me happy or angry about that. And so, mm-hmm. I might ask mm-hmm. you to say just a little bit about James Hillman's way of describing soul making, because it's somewhat of what we're talking about. And I know that both he and Louise Cowan are major mentors and influences on you. So,
yes.
So, maybe you could say a little bit about soul making.
Yeah. 2011, fall of 2010, by way of preamble, my wife had suffered a pretty serious stroke, and we had plans for that fall with my not teaching out here, which we then scrapped. So we needed to get her back as much to herself as is possible. So one thing that called me in that period was Jim's Revisioning Psychology, initially published in 1975. Yeah, you've got a copy there. That's great. Now, talk about a mythic text. This is you can't beat his thinking, which is actually mythopoetic. It's both. And I spent 4.5 months reading that, 3.5 pages, three and a half pages a morning, and wound up with like 135 pages of single-spaced handwritten notes. I think my handwritten notes rival the number of words in that page. But the part that gripped me was pages 99 to 104, pathologizing as mythologizing. And you could, a reader could meditate over those 5 pages. Now, Will's going to prove me right or wrong, if my memory's working.
That's the myth section right there.
Yeah, that's uh-huh. it. Those pages in what he uncovers about the nature and function of myth is, number one, worth the price of the book. And number two, you could read and reread those 5 pages for the next several years, being provoked into new ways of thinking about how myth is. Another line from Jim's book, since we have it out on the table, page 71 or 77, Will's going to check me and catch me now. The soul can do without its therapists, but it cannot do without its afflictions. Mm-hmm. For James, we grow, we become most mythical when we're suffering. It's not that we have to go out and look for it. Life will
bring it to us.
In platters sometimes in horrific ways. But when we're knocked off the normative and the conventional place that we all like to inhabit most days, because it lets us get things done. But when pathology enters our life, all bets start becoming questionable. And it's in those moments that the myth that we're in may have its best opportunity to be reformatted, restructured. I remember reading the meditative lessons of St. Ignatius Loyola years ago, and he wrote that out of an experience that he had when he became deathly ill as a young man and almost died. And in retrospect, he said, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it took him deep. I think he was probably deep anyhow, but it took him into places, as it did with Jung in his own crisis, So these places where pathology enters, and we don't need Jim Hillman, God bless him, and thank you, Jim, for writing that, to know that when we suffer pathology, something big starts to shift in us.
If I can circle back to some things you were saying earlier, from a point of view where, from a linear point of view, depression and problematic periods in our life are just purely negative from a linear point of view. But if you appreciate poiesis and process, then the darkest and most difficult parts of our lives can become part of a story, can become part of our growth process, and they often are. But it takes a point of view that's not simply linear or not simply APA to appreciate that. And so, I found one quote that seems to be maybe a peak of what you're talking about, and from Hillman's words. "So I began by examining various psychological syndromes as if they were mythical enactments, as if they were ways in which the soul is mimetic of an archetypal pattern." Mm-hmm. And I think that's...
And beautiful. And you touched two as-if clauses. Yeah. Because Vaihinger not only influenced Jung, Vaihinger is cited several times. I don't want to overdo it, but several times in revisioning. There's something about that as-ifness that lets us be fictions with approval. It's not like, well, you're lying. No, we can't help being partly narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are, it's not linear. It's more like a spiral.
Or a labyrinth.
Yeah. The geometry changes from that kind of egoic cause-effect linear.
Must put foot forward.
Yes, yeah. And there it is. But when we go to the as-if world, then we start moving in different psychological and poetic
dances.
Ways.
Yeah.
Yes, and music and...
I hate to throw another element into the mix, especially because we're running short on time here.
Oh.
But I'm going to throw this out anyway, and let's just say we have about 5 to 7 minutes left.
Okay.
Where does truth fall into the mix?
Uppercase, lowercase.
Okay, and now, all right, now define for me the difference between uppercase and lowercase.
Well, the uppercase truth would be a kind of absolute. And a lowercase truth,
that would be the fundamentalism aspect.
Yes,
okay.
And I don't want to, discard the idea that there are certain things ontologically present, metaphysically palpable, that are in fact capital T truths. Otherwise, I'd find myself as a freewheeling relativist, and I don't think I am. And maybe I have the Ursuline nuns in 8 years of grade school to thank or curse for that. But I think we make our truths through the myths that we become more cognizant of, mm-hmm. more conscious of. And so a hamburger patty may be the truth for me, mm-hmm. and the sacredness of that same cow would be the truth for you. Hmm. Am I wrong to eat what you worship? Well, then, see, that opens up the huge thing. Well, it depends on context. Well, what myth, what collective myth do you come out of? How did you get there?
I like the contextual statement of, I think it was Paul who said in that aspect, don't do something that will cause another to stumble. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you can't eat a hamburger,
right.
But don't do it in such a way that interferes with another's path, if you will.
Fair enough.
And that's one of the things I think that I have learned over the years is, and it's been a hard lesson because I've gone up against a lot of religious folks and asked some of the really hard questions, and a lot of the answers didn't make sense to me. And so I challenged. Yeah. And then I realized that, okay, it's great to ask the questions, but you don't have to try to beat the other guy up to try to convince them that they're wrong because your thought process is going in a different direction.
Yeah, so much time.
Hold to your thought process.
Yeah.
And continue to work on it.
Yes.
And then maybe even open up a little bit to trying to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And that makes good. A huge difference.
Right.
Before we wrap up our program, and again, we are getting close on time, I want to remind our listeners, you are listening to Tell Me Your Story. We are talking about Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. We're here with Dennis Slattery and also with Will Lynn, who will be back with us again next month, the last Saturday. In Saturday or Sunday in February, and each month thereafter, as we put together 12 programs in the light of Mythosophia. And again, if you're interested in finding out more, the title of the book is Writing Mythology, Mythological Writing.
Writing Mythic Writing. Yes.
Writing Myth, Mythic Writing. And again, the author is our guest, Dennis Slattery. And before we wrap up the program, I have three final questions for you that I always ask on this program. Mm-hmm. I've asked Will the same three questions, and we'll start with the first one, which is always a good place to start.
Yeah.
Who is Dennis Slattery?
And may I, real quick, because one other thing I wanted to get in is a little bit of history that you've been a part of. So in answering that question, maybe you can say a little bit about your time in Dallas and your time in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. As a
if that's
part of your answer.
Right, exactly. I've never prompted my guests to ask from it because someone has asked me, well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
I say, well, what does the question say to you? So.
Yeah.
I say to you again, who is Dennis Slattery?
Dennis Slattery is an Irish-American writer, sometimes full of more blarney than he's worth, who's been riding motorcycles for 45 years and has a wonderful biker babe wife who loves to ride the Harley Electroglide Classic with him, and who loves being a father and loves being a grandfather to two beautiful granddaughters.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, good question. I give writing retreats around the country, and I've given them in Italy and Switzerland. I love presenting these, often through this book. Actually, the book is a consequence of doing it, so that people begin to see, grasp more fully, and love the narratives that they are. Hugely important for me to continue to try to do that.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
I think we're the most fragile things on the planet, the most dangerous thing on the planet. And I think our power is approaching infinity, and that may be our greatest shadow.
Hmm. Well, I have to say that I always hate for these kinds of programs to come to an end, and we're going to have to somehow make a way to have him back on the program again in the near future. Will, thank you for sharing this time with me.
Good job.
This has been great.
Thank you, Dennis.
Good job.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of myth and wisdom. Again, facebook.com/Mythosophia if you would like to get more information about what we're talking about, as well as see the videos that will be available. And until next time, I'm Richard Dugan. Love to Lal.